This edition of The Briefing was first broadcast on the 15th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 20:00 in Beijing, 15:00 in Moscow, midday here in London, and 9 a.m. in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Coming up on today's programme, significant developments in the Middle East. Hamas has proposed a new ceasefire, the US has imposed targeted sanctions on some Israeli outposts in the West Bank, and Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, has publicly criticised Netanyahu.
At this critical juncture, I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel.
We'll have more on all of this from our Middle East correspondent. We'll have a look at the Chinese economy as property prices continue to fall whilst exports are surging. Then Russians begin voting today in an election which Vladimir Putin is certain to win.
The history of the human civilization has shown us time and again that every single dictatorship believes itself invincible until it falls. And the same fate will befall Vladimir Putin.
We'll hear from the wife of a Russian political prisoner, and we'll have a roundup of culture news. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. Hamas has presented a new ceasefire proposal which would involve the exchange of hostages for Palestinian detainees. This comes as Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader and the highest-ranking Jewish official in the US government, who's long been a supporter of Israel, called for fresh elections, saying that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way. In a related development, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on two Israeli outposts and three settlers it accused of undermining stability in the occupied West Bank. Middle East correspondent Greg Karlstrom can tell us more. He joins us now from Dubai. Greg, many thanks for coming on the show. I wonder if you could give us the details of this new ceasefire proposal.
The public response to it from the Israeli government has been very dismissive. Prime Minister Netanyahu called it preposterous, and he said he would update the Israeli cabinet about it in a day's time. But in private, the response is a bit less dismissive. The proposal sort of builds on what we've been all talking about for the past 2 months. The idea here is a short-term ceasefire, probably about 6 weeks, that would facilitate the release of Israeli hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. There were two reasons why that deal didn't get done before Ramadan. There was the big one, which is that Hamas was unwilling to accept the temporary truce. They wanted a permanent ceasefire. And the other is that Hamas wasn't willing to put out a list of the Palestinian prisoners that it wanted released. This offer that they've put out in the past 24 hours seems to make some movement on both of those issues. It does call for a permanent ceasefire, but only in the second phase of this agreement. So it would start with something temporary, and then there's some vague language about trying to make it permanent. And from Israel's perspective, that might be something they can live with. And it also includes a detailed list of the prisoners that Hamas wants released, the Palestinian prisoners. The Israelis say the number of prisoners is still too high, but again, they say there's a bit of movement here that they can work with.
So who's mediating this, and what are the chances that an agreement can be reached?
The talks have been ongoing in three places over the past few months. They began in Paris, where American and Israeli officials met. They've moved since then to the Middle East, to Doha and to Cairo. So you have both the Qataris and the Egyptians who are trying to broker a deal. And the Qataris are said to, in recent days, have applied some more pressure to Hamas. They have threatened to deport, to expel some of the Hamas officials who have been living in Doha for years, threatening to throw them out of the country. And they have put enough pressure, I think, on the group, not only to bring them back to the table, but that even the Israeli government, which usually has very little positive to say about Qatar, put out a statement in the past day or two thanking it for its efforts to apply pressure.
Mm-hmm. I wonder now if we could have a look at Chuck Schumer's remarks and whether that's going to move the dial at all.
It was remarkable to hear him give that speech last night. This is someone who, if you think back to 2015, Barack Obama was trying to get the nuclear deal with Iran through Congress. Benjamin Netanyahu flew to Washington to denounce it. Chuck Schumer was one of only four Democratic senators who voted against that deal, who sided with Netanyahu, in effect, against Barack Obama. So to hear him come out and say that Netanyahu had lost his way and call for early elections, he is the last person, I think, in the Democratic Party who you would have expected to say something like this. Now, whether it's going to mean anything in Israel, I mean, there's two ways that you can look at it, neither of which are very optimistic. One is to say that Israelis don't like being told what to do by any country, including the United States, and that perhaps this will give Netanyahu a small bit of additional support from people on the right who maybe have lost faith in him but don't want to take orders from America. The other way you can look at it is just to say it's the same problem we've had for 5 months. Three quarters of Israelis want Netanyahu gone, but there is still no mechanism right now to force an early election that could remove him.
The elections are slated at the moment, is it, for 2026?
That's right. And there's been some talk about, you know, trying to do a no confidence motion, trying to bring down the government prematurely. But you need to get a few members of the coalition to support that no confidence motion. And they can read the polls as well as anybody else can. They know that if they bring down this government, they're likely to wind up in the opposition after the next election. And that gives them an incentive to hold together.
Can we have a look at the new U.S. Sanctions? These are targeted sanctions on bodies or people in the occupied West Bank.
And this is the second round of American sanctions applied to Israeli settlers. The first ones about a month ago were applied to four individual settlers. These, as you said, to three settlers and then also to two outposts, which are Israeli settlements that are built without the government's approval. So they're not just illegal under international law, they're also illegal under Israeli law. You can look at this and you can dismiss it and you can say it's a very small thing. We're talking about individuals, small outposts, treating the settler enterprise as if it is the work of individuals and not something that has had state backing from the Israeli government for decades. But you can also look at this and say it is a real shift in American policy to treat Israel a bit more like it treats any of its problematic partners in the Middle East, countries that the U.S. has used sanctions against, countries that the U.S. has threatened to withhold military aid to or arms sales to at various points. Talking about Israel that way, instead of as this indispensable ally that can do no wrong, is a real shift in American policy. Maybe it doesn't go much further than that right now, but I think it will have long-term implications for the U.S.-Israel relationship.
Greg, thank you very much indeed. That was Greg Karlstrom talking to us from Dubai. Now, here's Lillian Fawcett with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Georgina. Turkey and Iraq have reached a landmark security deal to crack down on Kurdish militants in northern Iraq. The agreement comes as Ankara and Baghdad work on building a trade route between their countries and restarting a key oil pipeline. Two Senegalese opposition leaders have been released from prison by a presidential amnesty just days before a national election. Ousmane Sonko and the presidential candidate he's backing, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, were met by hundreds of their supporters in the capital, Dakar. Japanese unions have secured their biggest wage hike in more than three decades after employers awarded an average 5% increase for the new financial year. Many of the country's biggest firms, including Toyota, Panasonic and Hitachi, met demands in full. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you, Lillian. Russians have begun voting for their next president, an election in which the result is all but guaranteed. But even amidst the pretense of a free and fair election, hundreds of political prisoners are locked up in Russian jails for criticising President Vladimir Putin or Moscow's war in Ukraine. One of them is journalist and political activist Vladimir Kara-Murza, who is serving a 25-year sentence for treason. He's permitted to walk, read and write for 3 hours each day. The other 21 are spent alone in a tiny cell. Ahead of Russia's election by name only, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Vladimir's wife, Yevgenia Kara-Murza, who recently met with the UK's foreign secretary. Andrew asked Yevgenia if Lord Cameron had suggested how he might help the British-Russian national get free.
We did not discuss the particulars. I know that the position of the UK government with regard to hostages remains the same, which means that the UK government believes it should not engage, to not give incentives to those dictators around the world to take more hostages. In my opinion, this position is not the right one. It is not acceptable in the 21st century in a civilized world anymore, because whether they engage or not, the number of hostages and political prisoners around the world is on the rise, which shows that the only thing such a position can achieve is to send a message to UK citizens that if ever any of them end up in a situation like this, they're basically on their own. And I don't believe that a democratic government can be allowed to send such messages to its citizens. I believe that the more responsible approach would be to join efforts with other democracies around the world to try and build instruments to prevent such malign practices of hostage taking and imprisoning people for political opinions in the first place, from being used in the first place.
Could part of that be, and I know this is a suggestion that Vladimir has made in a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, that on the other side of Russia's presidential election, and I hope our listeners can hear the inverted commas around the word election, that the world simply refuses to recognize President Putin as the legitimate leader of Russia, much as they have done before with characters like Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela?
I completely agree with my husband that this would be a very morally, ethically correct thing to do, but it would also be a very strong message both to the Kremlin and to Russian civil society, to those Russians who have been risking their freedom and very often their lives to oppose the regime, to show to the world that we strive for a different Russia, for a democratic Russia that respects the rights and freedoms of its citizens and lives in peace with its neighbors. And I believe that by declaring Vladimir Putin, illegitimate, by actually calling a spade, the world would send a very clear signal both to the Kremlin and to Russian civil society. And I believe that this step is very much needed today.
On that subject, the subject that is of a different Russia, I'm speaking to you from the studio here at Midori House, where I recall sitting down with Vladimir many years ago now and being struck by his optimism in spite of everything, that one day Russia could be a, well, for want of a less pejorative word, normal country, another European democracy. Do you and he still have that optimism, even in the wake of escalations like Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the recent death of Alexei Navalny? Are you still able to be optimistic about your country's future?
Of course, I am still optimistic about my country's future because of all of those people, tens of thousands of people who went out to lay flowers to Alexei Navalny despite the very heavy police presence, knowing that they would be filmed and that they might face persecutions for that. I do know that our country can have a different future because of all the people I've been working with for these 2 years since the full-scale invasion had broken out. All these human rights advocates, human rights defenders, these journalists, these activists who are doing everything they can to weaken the regime in the Kremlin, to bring closer the day when this regime falls and we get a chance at building a democracy in Russia. And Vladimir always says that his optimism is not an optimism of a misinformed person, but his optimism is that of a historian. Because, you know, the history of the human civilization has shown us time and again that every single dictatorship believes itself invincible until it falls. And the same fate will befall Vladimir Putin, I am absolutely sure. We just need to do everything we can to bring closer the day when it happens. And when he actually faces, I want to see him on trial. I want to see him on trial for the many, many crimes that he and his regime have committed. And I want to see him in prison for the remainder of his life.
Just finally then, and on that subject, we've seen in recent days an apparent escalation of raids by Ukraine in Russia itself, drone attacks on refineries and other sorts of infrastructure. it's understandable why Ukraine sees that as a means of defending itself. But do you think attacks like that do threaten Putin? Do they undermine him, or do they have the opposite effect of, you know, rallying the people around him because they perceive their country as being under threat?
I think that it shows those attacks I don't think how much they weaken the regime in the Kremlin, but I understand that they will show to those people, brainwashed people in Russia who have been living under the influence of propaganda for so long, that the war is not somewhere out there. It will come to every family and to every house. This war has to stop. Russian military has to leave the Ukrainian territories. The occupation has to stop. And unless that happens, the war will continue. And I believe that this is a strong message to those Russians who still believe that it somehow does not affect them, what is happening in Ukraine.
And that was Yevgenia Karamurza speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. House prices in China continued to fall in February, whilst the export market is surging. Victoria Scholar is head of investment at Interactive Investor and joins me now to analyse China's economy. Victoria, thanks for joining us. Why are property prices still falling there?
Well, China's in the midst of a long-standing property crisis dating back to 2000 and 2001, when its biggest house builder, Evergrande, collapsed. And many people in China at the time put their life savings into a deposit and down payment for a new property, and they were unable to get that money back from Evergrande. And those woes continue. There's another state-backed property giant, Vank, that's fighting on the brink of collapse. And as a result, we're seeing that home prices continue to fall, both in terms of new home prices across various cities and existing home prices as well. So it looks as though those concerns about China's embattled property crisis continue.
Mm-hmm. Why does it matter?
Well, China's property sector is a key growth engine to its economy. It's part of the reason why its economy boomed in the years prior to sort of 2018, 2019. Of course, a lot of individuals and households put their money into deposits. And also there's a booming commercial property sector as well, with the rise of office spaces in mega metropolis cities. So the fact that that growth engine has been stuttering is negative, not just for China's economy, but also the global economy, because many countries around the world are intertwined with China. When China sneezes, the world catches a cold.
And how is the Chinese government then trying to stabilise the market?
Well, it's set out an ambitious growth target for this year of around 5%, a figure that many economies would only dream of. And it did manage to achieve growth of 5.2% last year. But it is still dealing with the property crisis, deflation and weak consumer confidence. So policymakers have been stepping up their support for the Chinese economy. They've been tightening rules against short sellers in the markets to stop major sell-offs happening across financial markets. They've been unleashing more cash for banks to try to encourage more lending to boost property growth and property loans. And they're also eyeing up possible interest rate cuts this year. So more favourable monetary policy dynamics to try and kickstart the economy and get rid of that deflation. But the concern with lower interest rates is that it can lead to widening interest rate differentials with economies like the US, and that can actually hurt China's currency and exacerbate capital outflows. So that's why possibly we haven't seen any interest rate cuts as of yet.
Meanwhile, can you tell us what's happening in the export market?
Well, we've been seeing that exports have actually been improving. That's partly because of an improvement in China's trading partners. So we saw that exports outpaced expectations in the first 2 months of the year. Imports were also a bit better than expected. This is a trend that we've seen not just in China, but in other economies like South Korea and Taiwan and Germany. And part of that is because of strong demand for semiconductors and that recovery in global trade that's partly driven by the electronics sector as well. But this is also partly because of very weak year-on-year comparables that flatter this year's figure after very weak export figures around this time last year.
And why is this prompting fears of a global backlash?
Well, I think that there's an argument that China's been looking to compensate for the issues in its housing crisis by focusing more on building factories and exports instead. And that rise in factory output has negatively impacted some other rival economies that are major manufacturers, such as Germany, for example. So we've seen that the European Union said that it's potentially looking at a tariff, an import tax on electric cars arriving from China, because if we're to see a huge boom in Chinese EVs to around the world, we know that that could hurt all important car industries in other economies, such as Germany. And that's not the first imposition of a tariff we've seen. We know that India, similarly threatened by China last year, said that it was looking or imposing a tariff on steel from China, and also the European Union has been looking at possible restrictions on wind turbines and solar panels as well from China. So it's kind of a case of these economies looking at ways to protect themselves from possible manufacturing increases in output in China.
But China does seem to be finding ways around some of these tariffs.
Yeah, I think that's right. And China's authorities have been looking at innovative ways to try and kickstart this stuttering economy because it's been in the doldrums for some time. We know that it was stuck under pandemic lockdowns and restrictions for much longer than we were in the UK or in the US or everywhere else. And that really hurt its economy. We didn't see that blockbuster post-pandemic surge in demand that many were hoping for. So it is certainly looking for ways to try and stick to that 5% growth target that Beijing has laid out at the beginning of the year.
Victoria, thank you very much indeed. That's Victoria Scholar. And this is The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Now, South Korea has the world's lowest fertility rate, and between 2013 and 2023, the country saw a 40% decline in marriages. One of the top reasons for this is the high cost of weddings, but culture is coming to the rescue. With me in the studio is Carolina Abbott-Galvao, who's our associate culture editor. Tell us about this South Korea story. It is a lovely cultural story.
It is really interesting. And the thing is, when I read it, I just found myself wondering if I would like to get married in a museum. It seems like an odd place to do a wedding, but at the same time, could be nice to be around all those paintings and around all the art. I'm not sure. Would you like to get married in a museum?
I think it would be a fabulous place for a party. Let's just see exactly what the state is saying. They're saying because of those declining birth rates and marriages and so on, because it's just simply too expensive for people to get married, they are going to let people get married in public museums, in parks, in galleries.
I think that's a great incentive. And I mean, if it is the cost that's really stopping a lot of people from getting married, then, I mean, and weddings are super expensive, then it's a great thing. And I mean, yeah, I guess we'll just have to see if it works, really.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure how far that goes in upping the birth rate, unless they're providing some kind of privacy there, too.
I don't know, yeah.
Oh, dear. Right, let's move on, because I know you've got a lot of culture stories for us today. And I'm just coming back to this. Let me just find your stories here, Carolina. So we are looking at Keir Starmer. Now, he, of course, is the UK Labour leader. He is probably the next prime minister here.
Yeah.
And under his government, he says that he wants to turn the arts from a luxury to a necessity. Give us the detail on that.
So, yeah, what Keir Starmer was saying is that the art industry and culture in general in the UK has just become increasingly prohibitive to people who come from a working class background. People who are able to access the arts and work in the arts industry have to have sort of wealth to begin with. And that is true in the UK. And that has a lot to do with, you know, London in general is extremely expensive to live in. And if you want to work in the arts, you have to live in London. And so it's simple things like that. And what he was talking about as well is that, you know, I think we've come to forget that the arts can actually be a really important soft power tool for this country. And, you know, if you look at the UBS report, the UBS Art Basel report that came out earlier this week, the UK art market, which used to be the second biggest art market in the world, that is slipping and it's becoming, you know, and it's due to things like this. It's due to the fact that the art world is increasingly inaccessible. So, I mean, it is a good move from him, I think.
Mm. I've just been reading Andrew O'Hagan's new book, Caledonian Road, and this is something he talks about in there. And he points out that, of course, you can make art accessible. For instance, it's free to go to the National Gallery. Yeah. Anybody can go there at any time. Surely the thing here is that you have to know that it's there. Mm. You have to want to go there. You have to be brought up in a culture that values that.
Exactly.
And quite often that's not the case. It's not just a question of saying, let's make it more accessible. You have to create that desire.
Exactly. And I think it's exactly what you're saying. It's about, you know, it's about making people aware that they can actually be able to, they can actually value it in the first place, and that it's not sort of this silly thing that that isn't this world that is just completely closed off to them, which it can seem that way now just because it is so hard to, you know, if you want to be an artist, for example, or if you want to work in the art world, it's difficult and you have to have wealth to begin with. And so I think people are often encouraged to go into other careers, that, you know, and if you want to be in that world, it's seen as this silly sort of pursuit. But it's about what you're saying. It's about kind of challenging those views, I guess.
Mm. Well, the book world has had a great boost in the introduction of a new prize. Mm. So this is the Nero Prize for Literature. And last night, it was the very first one. And I have to say, I've very rarely been to such a well-organised event. It was absolutely seamless. But the award was won by Paul Murray with The Bee Sting, which was the book that narrowly missed out on the Booker Prize. So, of course, that was a big celebration. Going on for that. Now, let's have a look at this piece that you've commissioned for the magazine about a French government body that stores furniture, painting and art.
It is a crazy thing. Yeah, I sent... So I commissioned Claudia, who's our amazing researcher, to go to France and report on the story. And so the Mobilier National is basically this government body that stores all the furniture, all the art that gets sent to France's official residences and embassies abroad also. And so from Macron's house to the French ambassador in Japan, these are the people who are storing and taking care of everything that's in those places. And they actually get to fix and repair some of those things as well and create new artworks and new pieces. They do a lot with textiles, and you know, she was able to see all of the places where they're stored and where people are making new things, and it's just sort of this amazing place. And I mean, when you talk about storage, it doesn't seem like something that's immensely exciting, but actually, if you look at the photos, you'll see that it is just absolutely beautiful.
It sounds amazing. Thank you very much. That was Carolina Abbott-Galvao there.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for this edition of The Briefing. Our researcher was George Ruskin. Our studio manager was Steph Chungu. Our producer was the fabulous Lillian Fawcett, and this was her swan song. We shall miss you tremendously, Lillian. The Briefing will be back on Monday at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.